Interestingly, the law carves out, you know, certain economic developmental entities whose mission or purpose is to develop or promote economic growth of a state agency or political subdivision with which the entity contracts, but only if the entity doesn't receive $1 million or more in public funds. So I think that's a very interesting thing is, you know, what's the governmental entity that you're working with? And of course, the statute lays out what are trade secrets and what contracting information is. I think one of the things that I always found rather distasteful, for a delicate word, is when I was on the Housing Authorities Board and we got a public, an open records request, was that you only had 3 days to respond. That is a very, very short period of time. And so, you're going to want to see if you can fall into an exception. And so I think, you know, really read your governmental contracts closely. I think, read these particular statutes on the open meetings as well as public information very closely. Another point I want to make, because I think it's important for everybody in the audience to know, is that Senate Bill 944, also passed in the 2019 legislature, makes certain personal devices that you may be using and part of your role, you know, as this nonprofit leader that you're using to communicate about that governmental contract, might be subject to disclosure. And so again, I go back to my experience, and this is before 2019, but as a commissioner, I would not have any of my housing authority emails sent to my iPhone. I was like, nope, not doing it. I'm doing it on this old laptop, because if it ever has to be subject to, an Open Records Act, I don't want my clients, I don't want to have to argue that, hey, I've got attorney-client privilege so you can't look at it. So it's a minefield. I mean, it's important to get these governmental contracts because they fund such good programs, but you want to be cautious about that. And so finally, as if that news was not bad enough, there's the Texas Business Organizations Code 22.353, which I think we've talked about here. And if we haven't talked about it at UT, we've talked about it at the State Bar Conference. And that statute requires any Texas nonprofit to make their financial books and records available to any member of the general public. It is incredibly broad and it is incredibly vague, and it is a pain in your side to, try and comply with that. And I've helped clients work through that. I've gotten into fights with DAs about, the vagueness of that statute. But I think the best, offense, right, is a strong defense, which means reading those contracts carefully, reading the governmental code carefully, and maintaining good compliance, good records, good accounting of what's going back and forth between you and the governmental entity. And with that very detailed response, I will turn it over to John.
Thank you. And I'm glad you had to take that question and not me. That's a complicated body of law in Texas. I'm not even going to try to delve into New York. Nobody asked. Thank goodness. Hillary, I know that when preparing for this talk, one of the things that we talked about somewhat was cryptocurrency or digital currency. And I learned when we were talking that you actually had some experience giving away to charity on behalf of a client cryptocurrency. And I'm curious to know how that went and kind of what you're seeing out there in the world of people using this newfangled kind of property to make a gift.
Thanks, John. Yes, it's really interesting. I think it's something that will continue to raise a lot of relevant issues as obviously in the current economy, it's a huge asset that people have on their books and are curious about how to deploy it into the marketplace. I found that when we were looking into this, that using a donor advised fund who had experience managing contributions of cryptocurrency or digital currency was very helpful. And so I know that, for example, Silicon Valley Community Foundation has had many years of accepting types of currency, and that they're sort of stance and approach to that is to, you know, it will go through some additional process as opposed to a cash or a marketable security contribution. And so I think that it's really important to ask a lot of questions and not sort of be on a very tight timeline when you're trying to make that type of contribution. And if you're wanting to support a public charity or a smaller size institution who may not have the internal legal expertise or experience accepting these types of contributions, that using a larger donor advised fund who will have that expertise. And I think it even gets more interesting and challenging as there's new types of digital currency. So of course, Bitcoin being something that, you know, maybe has been in the marketplace for a while, as you get into some of these newer types of crypto, you know, you will start running into the same types of operational considerations. And then on top of that, I know there's a lot of tax implications and things for the donor to consider. And John, I would love it if you would speak to us about those specifically.
Sure. I think that the word currency in the term cryptocurrency is a bit of a definitional problem for people, in that some people will assume that if it's currency, it must be cash. But for tax purposes, the IRS has been very clear that cryptocurrency is not the same as cash. And there have been a lot of debates about what it is for tax law purposes, for securities law purposes, et cetera.